just below this, the descending force gives off four cruciform rays, which follow the lines of the sutures of the physical skull, while the main stream of egoic force naturally passes still further down the body through the throat chakram into the heart and solar plexus centers. By this time, I observed, the astral body occupies a space from the shoulder to the knees of the mother and is almost upright. The physical body seems to serve as a fulcrum or anchor, I thought, for the ego. The stream of force, which represents the consciousness of the ego, I found to be concentrated upon and within the head of the fetus, from which it passes on down the spine and can be seen, I notice, as a pale yellow stream or almost white light. There is also a connecting shaft of egoic power or life force which passes from the astral body into the head, descending not down the spine as I've just said and had observed, but through the throat and heart to the solar plexus. And this latter stream flows with the cerebrospinal current as far as the embryo atlas vertebrae that I see. Excuse me for using an anatomical term. I'm referring to the name of one of the highest vertebrae in the spinal column known as the atlas. Well, as I watched, this stream I am referring to was seen to flow with the cerebrospinal currents as far as the embryo atlas vertebrae. In consequence, it seemed to me, of these egoic currents of power, quickening was occurring when the conscious egoic impulse, having passed through the mental and astral bodies, touched the physical embryo brain. And then physical conscious incarnation may be said to begin, I suggest, at that moment. Heretofore, the actual incarnation began, I have come to the conclusion, at the moment of conception. From then on, the ego is incarnate in a physical means of existence. The first twin cell within the womb, the zygote, as it is called. So that first embryo, even at the beginning, is an actual living being, an incarnate spiritual self. And this brings us towards the time of delivery, approaching which it seemed that the ego put more and more of itself into his developing personality, naturally, as the period of 1 month before birth was approaching. The shaft of light which I have described, I see, is by this time nearly 1 foot wide as it leaves the causal body, and therefore egoic consciousness is now, 8th month I'm talking about, firmly established in both the mental and emotional bodies, and has penetrated into the etheric, so that the building of the mental and emotional bodies was at that time also complete. The egoic shaft, as I have ventured to name it, the shaft of light, enters the embryonic physical body through the anterior fontanelle, that means the crown of the head, and enlarges, spreads out, so it seems, to include the whole brain. And by this time, I see, the mental body is about 5 feet high. An astral angel is associated very closely with the new astral body, its beautiful aura also covering the mother, as with a lovely blue mantle. And through this mantle, I have noticed, to my upliftment, there occurs a descent of power from the feminine principle of divinity, the blessed world mother, known variously in olden days as Isis, Venus, and Ishtar, but in our more modern times as the Blessed Virgin Mary. From these experiences, if I may here interject the idea, there became very strongly established in my consciousness that the Blessed World Mother, referred to in the Gospel stories as the Mother of Jesus, is an actual living incarnation of the motherhood of the deity of our universe. A wondrous being indeed. The guardian angels themselves are her servants and messengers. Through them, I believe, she is present from the very first, guarding both mother and child, although day by day she draws nearer, until it seemed to me the birth itself takes place in her actual presence. And this I observed in the present instance very clearly and conclusively. I saw her, if I may so presume, watching closely the mental and emotional changes of the mother, entering with her intimately into all the experiences through which in motherhood she passes. At the same time, she helps to increase those expansions of consciousness which come in some degree to every mother during the period of her sacrificial act. And now to continue and gradually complete this account, of the investigations into the eighth month, the central shaft of light, as I believe I saw earlier and described, passes into the head of the fetus at the anterior fontanelle. The remainder of the shaft flowing over and throughout the rest of the physical body. When the core of this power stream reaches a position corresponding to the pineal gland, it enlarges into a kind of bulb, it appears to me, which includes both the pituitary and the pineal glands and intervening organs within itself. However, as I watched and tried to understand, indications of three lines of force are visible. Two of these enter the pituitary and pineal glands, respectively, while the third flows in the direction, as said, of the atlas vertebra and on down the spine. From this central bulb of power, if I may use such a term, as I watch, tiny rootlets or branches extend down towards and into the etheric double of the throat. A smaller bulb shape enlargement, similar to that in the head, occupies, I see, a space of approximately one quarter of the cubic content of the heart. And now, as I am endeavoring to watch, the mental and astral angels, at about 1 hour before birth, have withdrawn. But the presence, whether thought form or projection of her reality, I know not. The thought form of the World Mother remains vivified by her glorious self. This presence plays a very important part at this period, not only for the reincarnating ego, but potentially for the mother-to-be. It seems to me to prevent the mental and emotional bodies of the mother from vibrating unduly in response to the pain, vibrating beyond the rate at which personal consciousness in the physical body could be endured and maintained. Then the birth itself occurs. And as far as I can judge, the sacred presence of the World Mother is withdrawn. Comma, her form slowly disintegrating in a process that took some hours, as far as I, in this and other cases, was able to observe. After this has occurred, and when all the procedures of the processes of incarnation have been successfully performed, and the duties of coordination and adaptation have been carried out, the angels themselves withdraw. I close with a commentary upon that last remark. On one occasion, I was asked by physicians in London whether I could assist in removing a difficulty occurring after the birth of the baby. This was that the child refused to suck. Full stop. I therefore personally visited the scene, and after an attempt to discover the cause of the difficulty, saw that one of the angels was still present. It communicated to me that the contact between ego and body of the fetus had not been fully performed by this particular order of angels at the crown of the head. Full stop. The deva pointed mentally to this, and as far as my great limitations permitted, seemed to ask me to bring power to bear to assist in linking ego and brain completely. Full stop. This I tried to do under such directions and withdrew back to my home. Arriving there very early in the morning. Later in the day, I called the hospital to inquire about the condition of this baby. I thereupon strongly received the brief reply, "You overdid it." This presumably meant, as I later learned, the baby tended now to want too much to receive the nutriment. At this point, I propose to share with readers my account of two, amongst many other, totally unsought, unexpected events that drastically changed my life, physically and mentally. Full stop. One of these occurred early in the 1920s. 1924, I think. My wife and two friends and I had booked accommodation for our August holiday in New Quay, Cornwall, only to receive, just before we were going, the statement that the owner had become seriously ill and had to return home, removing from us the possibility of finding any holiday accommodation. Full stop. But the very next morning came a very strange letter. A lady, dear, comma, deeply respected and loved, named Mrs. Rachel Tideman, wrote saying that in her cottage in the village of Shepscombe in Gloucestershire, she had mentally been receiving an impulse to write to me, neither of us having met before, to offer the use of her cottage whenever I should need it. The invitation, almost miraculous it would seem, was at once accepted, and we spent a wonderful holiday there in. This experience making possible and leading to the next one, which I am about seriously to describe. One day, in that secluded valley where the village lies in the west of England, dictating to my wife Jane, I was lying on a hillside on the edge of the remains of a great beech forest. I was continuing, on request, my researches into the kingdom of fairy, and at the same time seeking ardently to enter, if so it could be, the sanctuary of nature's hidden life and soul. Suddenly, it seemed to me, the whole heaven became filled with light. My consciousness was caught up to a realm radiant with that light which never was on land or sea. Gradually, I realized the presence of a great angelic being, from whose consciousness to mine there began to flow a stream of ideas concerning the life, the force, and the consciousness of the universe, together with descriptions of their expression in angels and men. Thereafter, as the series of books received from received from this great being will tell, their title being the Brotherhood of Angels and of Men, I found myself daily entering that great ocean of the life and force and soul of the universe with its myriad denizens, the spiritual selves of men and supermen, and the vast company of the angelic hosts, the shining ones. I dictated to the best of my ability this experience to my wife Jane, and looking back I remember that I found the great angel to be supernally beautiful, majestic, godlike indeed, impassive, and as it seemed, quite impersonal to the last degree. As teacher to pupil, myself being fully conscious physically throughout, be it ever remembered, this angel began to tell of the angelic hosts themselves, their orders and degrees, their communion with man in Greece, in Egypt, and ancient Atlantis, of their place as ministers of the Most High, and even of that great dawn of creation itself, when the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy, as the prayer book says. This great being eventually suggested a name by which it might be known, and I here give this name, the one ever since used in reference to the angelic teacher, who, as I have just earlier said, really changed my life and my thinking. That name was and is Bethelda, Bethelda, comma, a Kabbalistic Hebrew friend, later translating that to me as meaning the angel of the house of God. Bethelda then spoke to me of the creative process, of the Logos as great composer, divine musician, and his universe, not alone as a manifestation of celestial movements, but also of perfected celestial harmony. He told of the great gods who assimilate the mighty creative chords in their primordial potency, and repeat and re-echo them through all their ranks, from the highest spiritual worlds to the realm of everlasting archetypes. These are the great sound forms, I gradually learned, upon which and by which the universe is modeled according to the divine idea and the divine word. Thereafter, the music of the creative song passes on to these lower worlds, where man responds to them, perceiving them as nature's varied forms. Thus, it seemed to me, when the master musician enunciates the great creative theme for his solar system, a mighty paean of song sounds forth in answer from the innumerable celestial beings. From and through them, as the sound of myriads of harps touched by immortal hands, this music pours forth to create, meaning to shape, the material universe. Since the great artist of the universe perpetually creates, the creative symphony is forever being composed and forever performed. Wondrously, and without most human beings know, all angels and all men and women live amidst these celestial harmonies, this music of the spheres. But, might I say, only he who hears takes off his shoes. Such, then, is the vision which once I had, granted to me by Bethelda, as I was lying on that hillside in England, which I always revisit with gratitude whenever I am home again. Thus the vision still lives with me, even as I dictate, and there has come with it the knowledge that the gods who once were so near to the ancient races of men were none other than the angelic hosts, and that throughout the great racial darknesses they have still been near. Then advanced the concept from Bethelda that the time will come again for that day when once more the gods will walk with men and collaborate in the building of a new age of light, beauty, order, and compassion. For that day, we human beings must prepare. So said Bethelda, adding that ugliness must be banished, war outlawed, brotherhood must reign, beauty enshrined in human hearts and revealed through human lives. Then, to a humanity united in one fraternity, the gods will again draw near, will reveal their immortal loveliness and lend their aid in building a new world, a new temple in which all men may perceive and adore the supreme Lord of all, in the form of the great Lord and incarnation of beauty itself. Such, in part, very small part, I fear, was the vision splendid to which Bethelda elevated me in those years of the 1920s, when, whenever freedom became available, the lovely cottage was entered and the investigations and reception of teaching continue. This, then, was the second of those two very remarkable events. The first being the letter and offering of the use of the cottage in Shepscombe, and the second, the one of the results, which was the revelation of himself to my limited awareness of the great angel known as Betheldar. As I close, may I say that as the later years of almost continuous travel followed, in the year 1936 and 7, I had the privilege of meeting a family of members of the South African people, the daughter of which was a very great artist, namely Miss Ethelwyn Quayle. We met again almost by accident on board ship, sailing from Adyar, Madras, to South Africa. They had read my fairy books and asked if I was the actual author. I assented, told the whole story, including that of Betheldar, and of further researches, and asked whether, and stated that it was my hope that one day an artist would paint pictures bringing the devas to the understanding of man through the eyes, as it were. At once the daughter, dear Ethelwyn, responded favorably, and in due course the wonderful pictures illustrating the later book, The Kingdom of the Gods, were painted at her home at St. James near Cape Town. See how far-reaching were the two events I have described. The use of the beautiful cottage in Shepscombe and the illumination by Betheldar himself, neither of these being for a moment anticipated, even imagined, and yet, like so many other incidents in my life, coming about and literally changing my career, shaping as it were, into its later form.